Okay. Do we have enough chairs? Looks like.
Yeah.
You okay?
Okay, well, good afternoon. I'm Cliff Corso. I am the CEO of Insight North America. It's the firm that you heard a little bit about, solutions provider. I am up here today with Jesse Fogarty, who is the senior portfolio manager working on this account. And I'm really excited to be able to talk to you a little bit more about Insight, give you a little more familiarity with the firm, and explain how we go about creating solutions for our clients. Particularly interesting when it involves outside managers, as it does in this case. So there's a deck in front of you, and I would start on page 4 of the Insight component of the deck.
That's the little one, isn't it?
What's your... Did you guys have it?
Is it this one? We get little ones?
It would work on the little one as well.
And this is the one that we got.
Yeah.
Yep. Should be on page 4 of that deck. That is it.
We like your green approach, by the way.
Yeah. That's subliminal. what's really important about a solutions model is communication, because you may hear of us referred to as a quarterback in terms of the asset and liability aware and matching. And we really can't be an effective quarterback unless we're communicating with yourselves to better understand and best understand the objectives. And so we built the organization in different pieces to ensure that we're connecting on coordination. Some of the key people are on this chart. Up at the top, we have a client team that will directly face off against Tim and your consultant so that we're communicating every day. In fact, one of those members, Rob Allen, is sitting in the back there. He's a senior member of that team. But there are other important components of the team. On the lower left-hand box, clearly the investment team is very important. We've got 6 of the key players here that will touch the account. The upper left person in the box, Jesse Fogarty, I mentioned earlier, is an experienced PM, 23 years in the industry, 20 at Insight. He'll work closely with the folks underneath there in support of building the optimized portfolio to satisfy the solution. Over on the right-hand side, in that same box, the bottom two folks, Terry Hendrickson and Kevin Lozier, are important for a different reason. In a liability or solutions-aware strategy, we can't just rely on our asset expertise. We need to have a team dedicated to understanding the liabilities, the constraints, and the complex pieces that are coming together to form the right solution such that for this particular mission, we're matching the cash flows specifically and precisely as they come due through time. So these two teams work together underneath a process that I'll describe later. And then we have a client service and support team to make sure that, as was mentioned, when a bond is supposed to pay off against the liability wired, we have people dedicated looking at that all day long in terms of the implementation. So it's a robust team as it needs to be in a solutions model. The next slide just gives you a little bit of a flavor. I think a lot of this has been covered, but just to recap, Insight is a $600 billion solution specialist. We are owned by Bank of New York, but we operate independently as the largest independent boutique underneath the Bank of New York platform. We are substantial staff, 686, heavily skewed toward the investment professionals. Over 200 investment professionals at the firm. I'll explain a little bit more about that. In the U.S., it's a global firm. In the U.S., we have 80 staff in New York and also skewed toward the investment professional, a component of our platform at 34. I will pick one thing out of this chart that I think captures what it is we're trying to achieve, and it is the key ingredient of our success, that first dash. We think slightly differently. We have a differentiated investment proposition, basically meaning we haven't set the firm up to just generate and manage products versus benchmarks and try to outperform on a total return basis. We do have that capability, and the track records are solid. But the largest portion of our firm is dedicated to the solutions model that we're talking about today. That's a slightly different proposition. We're looking to achieve the outcome that you're trying to get at. In this case, again, meeting benefit payments, liquidity, making sure that the mission of the association is solved. And so that is the main focus. And if you turn the page, you'll get a sense as to the scale of our solutions business. On the upper left-hand side of page 6, you'll see a breakout of our assets by approach. And that dark green pie, kind of like the Pac-Man eating some other things, is the biggest slice. That's our solutions business. We have a 20-year history in the U.S., and I'll touch upon that in a little bit. But we do also have multi-product capability and fixed income, currency management, small, but specialist equity as well. Our client type, our client base on the right-hand side is largely institutional. You'll see the breakout there. Again, there's a very dark, large pie there, and that is in the pension fund space. Part of the reason that is because the solutions model is a really good match for some of the objectives of pension funds globally. They're big consumers of the solutions product set, and hence the nature of that. But we do manage money for insurance companies, endowments, foundations throughout the world. Page 7. The asset side of the equation, fixed income, drives some of the solutions underneath the overall assignment. It's scaled at nearly $285 billion. I think the two points here, or the key point here, I think, is the breadth across these subsectors. In our minds, are required. Multi-sector is required to produce an optimal solution. We want to make sure there's diversity in the portfolio and that when we're trying to solve a puzzle, that we have a lot of different sources to go to help solve that puzzle. Over on the right-hand side, a little bit of a flavor for the U.S. component, about $30 billion, exact same construction, multi-sector approach, capability in corporate, treasury, agency, structured product, asset-backed securities. So again, a multi-sector approach to the solution set. Just a quick slide on the organizational structure on page 8 in the U.S., there's an 80-person team, as I mentioned earlier, in the U.S. I've had the pleasure to lead that team for 20 years. It's a very cohesive, experienced team. A typical example would be the investment and credit team in the middle of the org chart, about 34 people there, headed by Jerry Berrigan, by the way, who has about 23 years at Insight North America, nearly 30 years in the industry. That's typical of what you'll see at Insight. The senior investment team averages 20 years with 15 at Insight. And I think while really proud of that cohesiveness and record, I think the key takeaway for clients is that it produces that expectation of continuity as we move through time. And all the numbers you see that have been produced by this team.
Cliff, before we get too far from page 7,
yes.
If I could just ask you to comment, it looks like most of the fixed income assets are non-U.S. dollar denominated. I've been reading, hearing there's something in excess of $10 trillion in negative income, fixed income assets in primarily, I think, Europe. But
that's true, yes.
Where do you fit in that grouping? And sure. Do you own in this? And are you buying or considering buying negative income assets? And what are you doing about that?
Sure. We're primarily in the U.S. component of the market, where even though we just talked about our yields are very, very low, they look really high if you're sitting in Japan or you're sitting over in Germany. What we're seeing on our platform in the U.S. component is an acceleration of demand for U.S. fixed income, particularly out of Asia, South Korea, where the rates are low or negative. Again, our yield curve, we just talked about the 10-year. Today it's closer to 1.7%. But again, it's zero or negative in Germany, significantly negative in Japan. And we've got credit spread to add on depending on the product. And a lot of the activity that the global platform and Insight is seeing is being generated. Foreigners looking to invest, which, by the way, as an editorial comment, creates a little bit of a potential ceiling and how high our rates can go because of those flows across, you know, across the world. That's what we're seeing. We don't, would we invest in negative securities? I would tell you that I never believed you could see it, obviously incorrectly. But I think it's not so much an attempt at losing money, getting paid by that. Some of this has to do with regulations, capital, and a little bit has to do with protection and the safety, even at a slightly negative yield in the instrument. And the number is 42% of developed world debt is in negative territory. I didn't mean to shock you. I think I'm done here. Sorry about that. Not to bring it down. I would probably turn us to page 9, just a little bit more of a drill down on the fixed income team, which Jesse is a part of. The way we think about this is slightly different, maybe, than other models. The team is not set up centric around a particular product. I think you can think about this as building blocks. Each one of these green boxes are areas of specialization. And so when we're thinking about a solution, perhaps Jesse, in terms of the solution here, gets really to sit on top of this box and has access to all these different sources of diversification and opportunity to try to craft the optimal solution for the portfolio. It's a 100-person team, so it's pretty significant. My last slide in terms of the intro is the next one, page 10. I wanted to take it down just one more notch to give you a sense as to the degree of and depth of the credit research expertise we have. You're looking at our corporate credit research team. That's 24 people. I should note this chart does not include our asset-backed and structured credit risk analytical teams. That's another 18. There are 42 people dedicated all day long to specific areas of understanding credit in the bond market. And that's a really powerful resource because, again, think about this chart as well as building blocks. If we don't know what the optimal solution is yet, but we begin to build constraints and put them in to satisfy what the goal would be, we want to draw from the richness, the deepest richness that we can, to come up with that optimal solution. And again, final point, very experienced team. You'll see a lot of players here with 20, 25, 30-year experience. So I've seen cycles, are experts in these sectors of the market. And this is a significant resource when we're developing the solutions for your portfolio. Any questions on Insight?
Let me point out, just for our record, that the admonition that I can't read, too small a print for me, on confidentiality, you have waived. So this can be, we're a public meeting, and anything that's presented here is public, and I'm just confirming that you've waived the admonition, the restriction.
Understood.
Any questions? Cliff or Jesse or Insight? Jesse, are you going to make a separate presentation?
Yes, we're going to speak separately about the solution.
Okay. Notice, by the way, I sat in between my two companions from Insight as a similar.
We are
a similar
invited.
Smooth as on. Thank you. My name is Dave Pleka. I'm a global head of fixed income with Dimensional Fund Advisors. So I'm going to give just a brief 5 minute or so introduction to Dimensional. We don't have to go through the any pages for that. And then I'll come back and then talk deeper about the specifics of our fixed income strategy. So Ed had mentioned that Dimensional was founded in 1981. We had just celebrated our 35th year anniversary in April. All of us at Dimensional, we can always remember our anniversary day because it's April 15th, tax day. So the day you know that your returns are due, that's also another anniversary of the firm. But Dimensional was founded by David Booth. David was, a few years prior, he was a PhD student under Professor Eugene Fama at the University of Chicago. And that turned out to be a very fortuitous and profound relationship that began way back then. Professor Fama has had a 50-year-plus research and teaching career at the University of Chicago and became famous basically for some work he did on markets and studying markets as essentially as a price-setting mechanism. How good are markets at pricing securities. His thesis became known as the efficient market hypothesis, and a couple years ago, Professor Fromm was awarded a Nobel Prize for that work. James' work, in the end, he's basically saying what we all of us career practitioners in the market know, that markets are very hard to beat. And the reason that markets are hard to beat, it's not that there's not enough smart people out there to beat markets. The reason they're hard to beat is because there are so many smart people out there every day scrutinizing every bit of information and impounding that information into price. So we believe that markets do a very good job at pricing assets, pricing securities. But that doesn't necessarily mean that all securities have the same expected return. The next 50 years of Gene's research career has been about studying differences in expected returns across asset classes and within asset classes, and the equity side, as well as in the fixed side. On the fixed income side, he determined it's a very, very straightforward conclusion that there, that by and large, the variation in returns in bonds can be explained by two main what we call dimensions. The term or the maturity, or more technically the duration, it will explain the majority of price behavior, and credit quality is the other. So our strategies are going to focus along those two dimensions, term and credit. We are going to do this in a way that's going to be highly, highly diversified. So it's not that, you know, because we feel that markets are so good at pricing securities, we're not going to be in pursuit of the mispriced securities and take concentrated positions in those that we think somehow the market has undervalued. We're going to be diversified across literally hundreds of securities. So it's not going to be, you know, 50 issuers that are going to make up our investment grade portfolio. It's going to be between 200 and 300 issuers. Each individual issuer is going to have a very, very small portion of the portfolio. But collectively, we're getting exposure to the expected credit premium. And in my next session, I'll talk about some of the nuances on how we do that, simply because we're an investment grade manager. Simply because an issuer has an investment grade rating doesn't make it an automatic buy. There are names that we will not buy that do have investment grade ratings. We'll go into detail on that. So the process itself is very, very transparent. You know, in the end, you'll see that if you essentially looked at the shape of the yield curve, you would have a sense for where our portfolio positioning will be, and I'll get into more detail. And if you looked at credit spreads, you would have a sense of how we would be tilted within the investment grade, how much in AAA and how much versus how much in BBB. These are not static strategies. We focus on very, very liquid securities. That is hugely important to us. You know, the strategies, like I say, are dynamic in nature. There was a huge breakthrough in our marketplace in 2002 with the advent of TRACE. I don't know if you're familiar with TRACE, but essentially became the first of what I would call ticker tape for bonds. Something that the equity markets have had since the 1800s. This notion that, you know, when a stock trades hands 200 years ago, practically they decided, well, we should disseminate information about that trade. Not who traded it, not who the broker was or the buyer or seller, but just what the stock was, what the price was, and how many shares traded. It literally took until 2002 for that to reach the bond markets. We are a stodgy group, but we finally arrived. And we use that information, we'll talk about, to monitor the credits and to make our decisions on credit. So it's a transparent process. The Dimensional as a whole has in excess of $400 billion under management, almost $90 billion in fixed income. I'm the head of that group. It's a very experienced team, but the process is not dependent on one manager's or two managers' ability to forecast changes in rates. We don't believe we could do that. The good news is that we don't believe you have to be able to do that. We've been able to add returns over our benchmarks with a systematic approach that doesn't require rate forecasting or, you know, our ability to find some mispriced securities. So with that, I will open to any questions about the firm, and if not, I'll in my next session talk about in more detail what we do.
Questions? my comment that Booth, I believe, is the founder of, or the supporter of Booth Business School.
That's correct. That relationship is, again, it was a very profound experience in his life, and 40 years had passed, and one thing that led to another, and now the what was known as University of Chicago Graduate School of Business is now known as Chicago Booth, and there was he made a very generous gift, obviously, to make that happen, and but it was very, very meaningful. That relationship with the school and that relationship, and it's not just FAMA. There are a number of, when he was founding the firm, literally he went back to the business school and was going up and down the halls asking his old professors, well, what do you think about this idea? And associations with Myron Scholes and Bob Merton are both also Nobel Prize winners. Myron's on our mutual fund board, along with many others, Roger Ibbotson and Jack Gould and George Consonides from the University of Chicago. But Bob Merton works with us as a consultant, Ken French at Dartmouth. So if there's a sort of a distinguishing characteristic of Dimensional, I think it's that close ties with academia and financial economics.
Just one question. Your presentation listed Mr. Fama and Mr. French are providing consulting services to the firm. Do you have to pay a lot for that consulting services?
I will defer that one to my my companion.
Ted Simpson, relationship manager at Dimensional as well. They are consultants to the firm. This is, I actually don't know all the details, so it's easy enough for me not to share. But they are, our relationship with academics, to the extent that we use their research specifically in strategies, results in some sort of royalty exchange. The exact details of that I've never been shared with me, but that is kind of that concept. They also come speak for us, whether it's the consultants to us, like Tom and French and Merton, whether it's the fund board members going to pay for some things like that. They're also, I believe, certainly the case of FAMA, but French, I think, also. Shareholders of the management company as well. So there's a tight interaction there. Some of the payment of which is really what I do on the royalty side, using their research specifically in strategies.
Okay, thanks.
I take that as a yes.
Yes. Yes.
Bryce? Okay. Are there any more questions? I'm Bryce Doty. Thanks for having me and the rest of the crew here. I'm with SIT Investments, and we're based out of Minneapolis. Anytime you want to have us back in January or February, please do. I'm going to have you flip through a couple pages in this particular green book. It's a handful of pages during the introduction. The company was founded 35 years ago. Dean SIT, he has since passed away. Four of his sons work at the company. One, Roger Sitt, runs the company. It's interesting. He's not the eldest of the sons, but he's the most like his father. And it's been helpful for employee retention and whatnot because we all know that the company's going to be around for another generation. We currently manage $114 billion. We have 75 people, 36 investment professionals. And we are managing predominantly traditional stocks and bonds with an array of alternative products kind of on the side. The breakdown of the assets on page 3, $10 billion of which is fixed income. I've been there 20 years. I've been the head of the taxable fixed income business that whole time period, and it's amazing. 20 years doesn't impress anyone at SIT. At least 25 or 30 before they start to be impressed with longevity. Page 4 shows an array of products. The upper left is the short duration strategy that we'll be talking about with you all today. But as you can see, we have a broad array of separate account strategies on the top part of us and mutual funds on the bottom. The mutual funds, while they are a significant part of our business and really a reflection of whatever we do for institutional clients, the reason I bring that up is so I can plug the fact that Barron's just named us the number one mutual fund company in the industry last year, so I got to get that plug in. But we're very proud of that, obviously. Another thing we're proud of is highlighting page 5, and it's down at the bottom, the corporate goals. We love acting as a true extension of our clients' goals and needs. And so this has been great, just being a part of this discussion and seeing how we can interact. And one thing I would add to a question I think you asked, Jerry may have t- touch on is, you know, why the combination and or there's a question on the asset allocation. I think we also complement each other. So when you look at our risk-adjusted returns separately, it's probably not going to be as good as us combined. So we love being part of that kind of process and seeing how solutions can work for a client. Page six, the only other thing is that you're going to see us. You're going to see the portfolio managers directly. Tim is going to call us directly. Myself, Mark Brook, and Chris Rasmussen are the three portfolio managers that will be assigned to this. We don't have customer service people. We have lots of support staff and everything that we need. We just like the direct interaction because then you really can pinpoint and customize a portfolio to what the cash flow needs are. Again, you've heard that we have mortgages. There's a lot of principal and interest payments that come in every month. It's great for liquidity. It's great to help meet cash needs. You're going to see by the end of today, hopefully, that there's a lot of redundancy built into what Ed and Tim have put together. So if there is any, who knows what could happen in some other part of the portfolio, there's going to be $5 million a month coming in just in principal payments on the mortgages from SIT. And that's just, you know, backup that you probably would never need, but it's there. So there's a lot of pieces to this liquidity puzzle that have come together to make a good solution. Our overall fixed income philosophy is on page 7. There's a lot of words. Basically, we want to take the most amount of income with the least amount of risk. We're all about risk-adjusted returns. That's the primary focus there. The longevity of our team is on page 8, and this is just a subset of the people at SIT that would be primarily involved with your portfolio. The shaded area are the three portfolio managers that I named, myself, and Mark Book, and Chris Rasmussen, have been with me for over 15 years now. Mark has 30 years of experience. Chris is 16. They're fantastic. All of us are involved in all of the strategies. It's not like competing with each other. You know, the vision that we have for what's going to happen with the Fed or the economy or everything else, you know, affects everything that we do. There's a lot of overlap between our strategies too. What we do in the short duration strategy is the short duration component of our longer duration strategy. So it makes sense to have us all combined. They're very up to speed on everything that you're trying to do here. They've been involved in the process every step of the way. Actually, my whole group knows. It's great. We want everyone to understand the personality and the feel of each of the individual clients, and we're able to customize portfolios the way we need to accordingly. I think that was all I was going to highlight for now. We'll get to the product-specific stuff later. Any questions?
I had a quick one. You might spend just a moment on it. I had an earlier experience with your firm and another group I'm part of. And what was described at that point to us was your style of finding relatively short maturity mortgages, and effectively attempting to hold those to maturity as contrasted to them being paid off or refinanced, and your experience in doing it and getting a higher yield with that process. Is that primarily you still do that as your primary?
Precisely.
Okay.
Yeah, we've been doing that for 26 years, and we keep thinking that, you know, this will only last another 5 years, but we're still saying that. You know, it seems like it just perpetuates wherever the opportunity still exists, where we're buying these really old mortgages, very high coupons, the borrowers are paying 6.5% or higher percent interest. Most of them are refinanced, so the pools, you know, there's not that many loans left in the pools. And those remaining people will eventually gain around to refinancing, moving, death or divorce. Those are the reasons that we end up seeing a prepayment or loan get paid off. But essentially, the loans are just so small or old or just, maybe there's a credit issue why they can't pay it off. But we don't necessarily worry directly. We don't get hit by that default. It's Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or Ginnie Mae that would pay the loan off if there was a default. So it's worked out well. We, you know, some of these loans are like $50,000 or $100,000, not refinancing. You know, who's, there's not a loan officer targeting that customer to get a commission on that loan. They're going for the California loans. And those are the ones they're hitting. So it's the same strategy. It's a one-trick pony a bit. It works phenomenal. It's been a Teflon. The only negative year we had was 2013. It was 0.25% or something like that. It's been 6 years. Yeah, it's the same. It's the same thing you probably have heard about.
Okay, thank you. Wanda.
I would like to hear from Sid directly. What happened to your strategy in 2013, mm-hmm. which resulted in negative return, and what did you learn from that experience?
Yeah, there are a couple of things. If I have to refer to this, I will, but it's been etched into my brain because it happened on my watch. We had a negative return in a year, you know, and we've only had a couple of quarters that have had negative returns. But there were two things that happened, and if only one had happened, it would have been fine. The first was the highlight before the taper tantrum, where the second quarter of 2013 was just horrible. Rates shot up over 1%, and the mortgage sector was hurt quite a bit because everyone was expecting that they would get their principal and interest back on a 30-year mortgage in an average of about 7 years' time. You know, people do refinance, they move, whatever. Well, if rates go up, then there's no incentive for anyone to refinance. They're like, oh no, we're not going to get our money back in 10, 12, 15 years. At the worst possible time, when rates are higher, you wish you had a whole bunch of cash to invest now, right? Your bond is extended, it's terrible. For a high coupon mortgage, that's a home run. That's like the most wonderful thing that can happen, that you keep a 7% coupon longer than you might otherwise be able to. But with the whole sector just got hit. You know, it's like, get out of mortgages now. And that is another reason why it's good to have a combination of all of us up here. If you looked at that 2013, the blended portfolio would have still done quite well. And it's also the reason that we had such a great year the next year. We were at 3.99%. in 2014, because people are like, oh, the sky isn't falling. Extension risk is actually really good for high coupon mortgages. So then there was some differentiation that came into it. Normally, that would have been pretty obvious right away. What a second factor, and had been obvious every other time that rates had gone up. So typically when rates go up, they're like, okay, these high coupon ones are the ones to own. So they typically held up much better. And while they held up a little bit, they didn't hold up as well as they normally do. I want to have you look at the page. This is the second factor. And page 16, it looks like this. A bunch of squiggly lines on it. The green line is being measured by the left axis, the vertical axis, which is the percentage of people refinancing their mortgage each year. So the green line most recently has been between 10 and 20% of the people getting around or paying off their loan or moving or whatever. The other lines are put on here to show how jagged, how volatile traditional mortgage prepayments are. You never know when rates are going to move, and suddenly it's going to change when you get your money back. We don't like having to worry about a black box and worry about interest rates. We just want to know if we're going to get a certain amount of our money back every month, no matter what. But if you look, if that green line briefly went above 20% right as we were going into 2013. And some investors thought that line was going to continue to go up forever, and that this investment strategy of having mortgages that weren't going to pay off was going to go away. And so that hurt the price. Both things happened at the same time. And then you saw prepayments go down. Both concerns were alleviated, and we had this great, you know, 4% return the next year, and I had to tell all the clients, look, don't get used to that. This interest rates are low. It's a one-time deal. The reason that it went up above 20% was an odd event. I don't know I feel sorry for you if you actually remember rep and warranty discussion in the newspaper, but Fannie and Freddie were making all the originators, all the banks, take back all these defaulted loans because they said, hey, even though I've been current for 5 or 6 years, we're broke, and so we're going to find a reason for you to have to take responsibility for this default. And they went into the underwriting files, and they looked for every little tiny thing they could find that didn't fit the rep and warranty, that what was represented and warrantied by the bank to Fannie Mae as to the precise underwriting they did for a loan. So let's say you had, one of the things was you had to have a pay stub within 2 weeks of the closing, and the closing got delayed a day. Oh, now that pay stub was 1 day too old. Even though this loan is 5 or 6 years old before it defaulted, we're going to say you're out of compliance with your rep and warranty guarantee, and we're going to stick you with that defaulted loan. So the banks were really rattled by this, and they would not refinance anyone's mortgage that they did not originate to begin with, because they didn't want to take on this uncertainty. Well, the Fannie and Freddie realized that was becoming kind of disruptive, and they clarified it and said, all right, we'll cut you some slack if, you know, it's been paying long enough. So all of a sudden, for a 3 or 6 month period, the banks went after every old loan they could find that they didn't originate, and the originators are, and they went and tried to refinance them, and they hardly got anyone to do it. I mean, it went up like 18% to 23%, and then came right back down. So had that not occurred at the exact same time as the taper tantrum, we would have still had a positive return. Talk about frustrating.
Bryce, you may want to reference page 17 as well. I think that has your quarterly return. I think you raise a good question, and when we had asked as well, like, help me understand why you had a negative return, when we could expect that to happen. And page 17 has their quarterly returns going back since 91.
It's my 18. Maybe it's,
oh, 18.
Here,
okay.
Flip the page one more time. You're looking at the fund with all green bars. I like that one. Where we outperform over multiple years. But if you look at this one, which is unfairly shaded for every mistake that I've made, there it shades the negative quarters. There are 3 negative quarters in 26 years. It doesn't happen very often. There is some sort of multiple series of events. So the second quarter of 2004, we were down 14 basis points. That was the second worst quarter, the worst quarter in 25 years for U.S. Treasuries. That was the last, you know. So it takes something really extraordinary to get this to blow up, do that. And the 08, you know, it was up 5%. The flight to quality that happened during the crisis benefited these bonds because they had the government guarantee. People were bailing out of corporates and whatnot. So that's another reason to kind of have this loan. Yeah, credit over here, there'll be demand for that some days. There'll be demand for government guarantee some days. You know, and definitely the total is worth more than the sum of the parts in this case. And then everyone asks us to put it on page 19. They're like, hey, what can we expect when rates go up again? Because of 2013, well, all the other periods we do quite well because when rates go up, it's less likely that someone's going to refinance. Okay, so that's a positive for us. And we have this significant income advantage. And we actually do our income. I've already jumped the gun into the next phase.
I was going to say, we've already jumped
the gun. Safe to assume you fell short of your corporate goal in 2013 of having fun with your clients?
Yeah, it was. It's so frustrating, you know, and especially we, you know, pounded our chest, said, hey, we want a negative return, and then we got to hang our head and go around and said we lost 26 basis points. So, yeah, that was tough.
So off the topic a little bit, I'm honestly not pandering, but on page 8, you list all of your key personnel, 17, one is a woman. Mm-hmm. Is that reflective of your organization? Because my experience over my corporate years, I've dealt with some very smart financial women.
Oh, yeah. So
are they well represented in the organization or just not as well represented on your team?
Well, not currently. We have more on the equity side. Debbie Sitt, who I worked with for 20 years, passed away last year. She was a very senior member of the team. And we've had a few others. I don't know why Marcy isn't on here. Looks like Marcy got left off. So that's another
Okay, I just kind of jumped out.
Well, I agree that it's valuable. I tell my staff, I said, look, I don't want us to all agree. Many divergent views and opinions as possible.
I'm not assuming they would necessarily disagree with you. I just think it's good to have them on the team.
Clients that disagree, but I mean, it's just nice to have as many different perspectives as you can. I think that it is good to have a healthy mix of both backgrounds, whatever you want to call it, in order to get a better solution. Now, I've set up my team differently than most places. Most places, they have portfolio manager in the corner, got some analysts in the offices here, you got the traders out here that wait for the portfolio manager to tell them what to buy and sell. The analysts recommend to the portfolio manager the most pristine, cleanest, wonderful bonds that the portfolio manager ignores because they can't make any money off of them. They tell the trader, just buy what they want. The trader informs the analyst, hey, guess what you have to follow now? It's natural friction, that's the environment I came from. What we do is every analyst within the first year has to be able to execute the trades themselves. So we lay out the vision, we lay out the, here's where we want to be positioned on the curve, here's what types of bonds we're looking for, here's the goal. For this short duration strategy, our goal is to make more of the money market, provide optimal liquidity, and not lose money. We don't try to match the Barclays 1-3 year government. We try to form a solution for the client. And so when they have to find bonds that fit that need and that description. And so you get a lot more buy-in from the analysts, and you work better as a team. So as many people as possible piled into the trade room, so you have some control. I do value the diversity of the group and the different opinions.
Thank you.
Given that we've strayed over to strategy, maybe we can bring it back to Jesse, and you can talk about the strategy.
Sure. Tim, I was going to ask also, we could sort of agree upon a remaining time. I'm assuming the board is somewhat hungry.
Yeah.
Quick lunch, and then the balance of our agenda following that. So,
at the board's discretion here, I think,
for what it's worth, I've covered all mine. Let's get it, Jesse.
We've done three. Let's get the fourth one done.
All right.
Go, Ben.
Okay.
Sure. Just turning to page 13. Of the inside deck. There's been a lot of talk about solutions. The buy and maintain approach, which has been a cornerstone of our business for 20 years, really we think is a pretty eloquent solution. Really starting with the objective. It's meant to obtain structural exposure to the credit markets, capturing the inherent yield advantage. What we think makes it unique and a little bit different within this context really is the flexibility, the customization. When we started this assignment, really thinking about the needs of the plan from our perspective as a quarterback, the role we play, preservation of capital, liquidity, hitting yield targets, cash flow matching. We think it's a really efficient solution and particularly allows DFA and SIT very complementary. Our starting principles, our approach, really center on four key factors. The first is we only invest in companies with very strong fundamentals, very much taking a lender's approach when underwriting credit, looking at the stability of the credit profile not only today, but more importantly, what will it look like through a full economic cycle. The strategy is very much investment for the long term. This is a really kind of stark contrast to what we see to an index-based relative return profile. Really what we're looking to achieve is buying solid credits, avoiding any kind of credit deterioration. Very simple. Will we earn the yield that was promised when we purchased the bond? And again, stability of cash flows and meeting any kind of cash flow profiles within the context of the portfolio. The third, this is a little bit less appropriate for a shorter dated mandate, but philosophically how we approach buy and maintain. We think there's certain subsectors of the investment grade credit market that lend themselves to different term exposure. For instance, when we're looking at shorter-dated cash flow profiles or shorter-dated exposure, oftentimes we'll emphasize cyclical companies, companies that perhaps are in unregulated industries, asset-like balance sheets. We really gain our credit comfort from our ability to forecast cash flows and the ability to service debt. As we move out the term structure to 30 years, we're really focusing more on stable industries, regulated industries, asset-heavy industries, where oftentimes we're supplementing our analysis on cash flow with also asset coverage. An example that we really like in the long end of the market is first mortgage bond utilities. These are bonds that are they're issued by the operating entities of utilities that are secured by the property, plant, and equipment. A very, very durable asset class, trades at attractive valuations. Over the history of the asset class, there's only been two defaults. Both of those defaults have recovered at par. The fourth, diversification, not only on an issuer level, but also on a sector level. You know, the key theme here and philosophically of the firm is precision and diversification. We don't want one credit or one industry to dominate portfolio returns. And really kind of the four hallmarks. The ongoing management, there's kind of two things. While we're underwriting and our buy and maintain, the general approach is to hold to maturity. Both the credit PMs and analysts are very diligent and thinking about forward factors that may have any adverse effect on portfolio quality. What we think is neat with this structure is there's been some pretty significant structural changes in the liquidity of the credit markets subsequent to the financial crisis. And this, again, lends itself to lower turnover and hence lower transaction costs. Just turning to page 14 is a history. Again, this has been, buy and maintain has been a cornerstone to our business, a 20-year history in the product spanning multiple economic and credit cycles, where we think we've had a very competitive track record of experiencing zero defaults in just two distressed sales in 2002 and 2008, compared to the overall universe of Moody's defaults of 73. So we think that's a very kind of lends itself to our ability, our fundamental credit underwriting, and getting those credits right. You know, Cliff had touched upon this earlier, but I think one of the key differentiators when I look at this slide is, when you look at a 20-year track record, how oftentimes is the original team in place that's responsible for that? I took over managing this portfolio in 1999. Subsequent to that, it was Cliff who managed it before that. So, again, the stability of the team, the representation of the people responsible for that track record are still in place. That's kind of a very high level on the asset side. Would it be helpful to go into and speak about the quarterbacking and the completion?
Sure.
Okay, I think we can do that. Just if we flip the page to 16, there's a schematic here. I think that's probably the most helpful way to describe all these pieces we've been talking about today. How do they actually all come together? And to us, it really, if we think about it as a clockwise chart and we start at 9 p.m., that green line that goes out through time, 2020. The first thing we do is get in communication with the client. We need to understand the objectives. And here what we have shown is the key objective, one of the key objectives, meeting the liability payment as it comes due. That green line is the liability payment, benefit payment for the plan. So we then begin to think about how do we craft the universe of potential opportunity to satisfy meeting that liability at the most efficient way possible, whether by liquidity, yield, safety, diversification. Jesse described the buy and maintain process. You're looking at some of the screening tools for that process. The idea there, as Jesse pointed out, is not so much price appreciation, depreciation, or trading. It's really, do we get it right out of the box? Because we're looking for it to pay its coupon and mature on time. That's lined up against the liability cash flow. So we populated a potential universe of securities, which would also include treasuries and agencies, other securities that would fit the mandate. That's the potential mix of solution or available for solution. We read around to roughly 1 o'clock, and we have to ask the question, have we included all the externalities? In this case, we have external manager cash flows that we need to take account for. They're coming into the system. They're also going to be responsible for some money coming out of the system to meet payments. We need to begin to compensate and model for that. And then right below that, fourth, the constraints through conversations, through the way we think about trying to hit the objectives of the portfolio, we will create constraints, diversification, minimum quality ratings, maximum percentages by sectors, maximum by name, things of these nature, yield, such that when we put it into the optimizer that was discussed earlier, the optimizer takes all these constraints, the available pool of assets, takes in the liability, takes any external cash flows coming in, and then tries to solve for the optimal mix, cash flow by cash flow, to pay off that liability as it comes due. It's not as simple as just leaving it there, because what will happen then is we may want to adjust that slightly. There may be a better combination of bonds, and that's where Jesse will partner up with the liability team, the solutions designer, to begin to rethink, is there a slightly more optimal way to do this? And then we will stress test this for deterministic scenarios that are really rough ones and as well stochastic. And so it's a really powerful tool that we've developed over the years to come up with the optimization. 16 down the bottom line gives you a sense. This is a simpler run. It's not the solution you saw a little bit earlier. But this just assumes simply a $1.7+ billion deposit for the Provide portfolio. Through this whole process, what was the mix that came up to meet all those liabilities as they came due? And you get a little bit of flavor of the portfolio construction by looking at the corporates, the lighter green, the government securities, which are treasuries and agencies, in the darker green. But that portfolio satisfies, without reliance upon sales, the liabilities as they come due for the next 48 months. The one below adds in the other constraints, as were described earlier. The initial deposits are slightly different, and this is the fun part because this is a totally flexible approach to managing your portfolio against liabilities. We've incorporated in this bottom run each of the peer portfolios' expectations for cash flows. SIT is that red line. Roughly 5% of the liability payment is modeled there. The blue line is DFA, responsible for 25% of the liability. And then after that's determined, we come in and try to optimize on top of that. That's the quarterbacking component of it. How do we now finish off and complete the overall mix, given all these constraints, again, to meet that liability as it comes due? And not only does it do that for the initial deposit, it has flexibility and open capability for future deposits on annual appropriations. And those are on the top. You can see those coming in different colors in each year. And what that allows us to do is optimize not only today, but with an eye toward the future. We would expect to stay in constant communication, of course, with the association and with the consultant. To adjust this as time moves by. So it is quarterbacking, but again, with a really detailed connectivity to what might be going on in markets, in your plan, liability assumptions changing, whatever it may be. And we'll set to re-optimize again through time, depending on how things are evolving. So that's kind of it in a nutshell in terms of how all this comes together. There's a lot more pieces under it, but this is the main component of how we approach our solutions business.
Jerry?
Yeah, I understand, you know, you're talking about insight and how you, but the question I have, and maybe it's more for you, Ed and Tim, is how, if we adopt this program, how is the communication going to occur between these firms and what our goal is down the road? Are we going to set up quarterly meetings, or is there contact with these guys, or do they work through you? what's the plan with this thing in terms of communication?
So the primary point of communication is going to be through staff. We're going to be bringing through the actuarial projections, providing those to Insight. Insight's going to be building the model. We're going to be looking at the allocation of CD to sit in DFA and kind of having that collaborative conversation. To get this started, we're going to have monthly calls, probably much more than monthly calls. The reality would be as we get this ramped up, we're going to be able to drop those communications down to probably an email communication that says, SIT will deposit X number of dollars into the cash buffer this month. DFA will deposit X number of dollars. Insight, please confirm that your models are consistent with what we're seeing from our county group on our projected benefit payments here. And
that's what I'm asking.
And so that's going to come through my office.
Okay.
This is the critical cornerstone of FFP. It's going to be running through me in collaboration with these folks.
Okay.
As we get it ramped up, some of that responsibility gets to move over to Insight, the quarterbacking function. I become a monitoring aspect of that, obviously collaborating with the accounting staff and the actuary saying all the data is still correct here. It becomes that check on an established system as we get into the early part of next year.
And that actuary, excuse me, the actuarial front end is a projection each month of
yes.
cash demands?
Yes.
You can do it very simply. Here's the starting point, and here's what we're adding. But, of course, some will be dying, and in some cases we'll have beneficiary payments that are lower following a death or it disappears. Do they build all that into that cash expectation of payout?
Well, they're providing us with a four-year forecast. So when you're providing a four-year forecast, you know,
you've got to have
some assumptions built into that. So one of the components we have here, and you remember when we did the asset allocation, say we had a 1% target cash position, which equates to $75 million, or roughly 2 months of benefit payments today. So the buffer on that is if we're slightly off, if our projection is slightly off from the actual, we've got $75 million of cash there.
It will be.
Yes.
Of course. So.
And part of the testing here will be as we get the report cards up and running, there's going to be it's a twofold test. One, how accurate was the actuarial projection? And two, how well did the managers, specifically Insight, provide completion to that actuarial projection? So if we make assumptions about the Insight portfolio to get it closer to the actuarial projection, or get the actuarial projection closer to reality, we'll be able to see that and make closer decisions. You'll be seeing that from me on a monthly basis.
So we were asking similar questions in the due diligence process, and actually Insight was able to share some stories about other relationships that they have like this. Maybe you could share some anecdotes or something there along those lines so that we can see it from the other side of the world too, from what Insight sees of other clients.
Sure. You know, there's over 50 relationships managing about $30 billion in very similar capacities. I think the communication is, as everyone's talking about, has been key. You know, very very much out of the box, very frequency. You know, comforts and things have gone pretty smoothly. And, leveraging technology, so it's been very seamless from our front fit.
But there are examples. Mortality table may change. That's not shocking.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, for the pension thing, they tend to lengthen. So we'll work with clients to say, okay, that assumption's changed. What do we need to do to recorrect that portfolio so that it continues to meet the objectives that you're trying to meet? That'd be a really good example of working together. Shifting expectations as they will shift through time. Another example is based on market opportunity. We've had clients who have had a certain asset allocation and expectation through time, but have built flexibility into the portfolio to take advantage of things that may occur in the market that they find attractive. And so, by way of example, if the equity market, for instance, drops, but they find that attractive, they may want to tactically change course, shift this asset allocation mix, and then go and add more exposure into equities. And so we're really dynamically operating, on both understanding the liability side, the asset side, and what is driving the change in the asset allocation. We'll reload everything into our optimization process and come up with the re-optimized solution given those changing changing parameters.
So if we worked with the three firms, then we were talking about how to do that. So back to your communication question then. We're in September today. We don't imagine actually getting things in place until November and first benefit payments happening until January, as mentioned earlier. So it's a lot of building that infrastructure first before we actually have to rely on it to do what we think it should.
Building and testing. Yeah. Bryce, just quick. When I read all three of these, and like I said earlier, I thought I was going to have to pick one, and I'm looking at your numbers. I really like the numbers, and I went, oh, this is maybe we'll just all. And then I looked at your staff, and I thought, do I have to graduate from the University of Minnesota in order to come and visit you?
There is a thing, like,
their
level support, so, you know, you get recruited to go do U of M events, and yeah, it's a I think you would have to.
Jerry?
Tim, would it, is there any consideration or could there be consideration given to sort of a dashboard approach to this, not out on the website, but for the board's consideration that might show something as the expectation or the obligation that we have month to month in terms of benefit payments, and then the contributions that are being made by each one of these three firms out of their range or within their range, and an overall thing that's showing that we are meeting those expectations without being necessarily drowned in numbers. The numbers obviously will generate the dashboard. But, you know, if you see one of these dropping into the red or into the yellow, it suggests that we've got a perhaps out of balance situation. So a fat crayon approach for somebody like me.
Jerry has clearly hacked my computer and seen the drafts.
I've seen your draft.
That's exactly what we have.
I have some Russian friends.
That's exactly what we have in mind. Here are the actuarial projections. Here's the expected contribution from each manager. And okay. Here, when I say report card dashboard, we'll call it what we want, but it's going to show that, you know, how well did we match this? Do we need to make any corrections here? What is the yield component? What is the credit quality profile of the consolidated account? And hopefully it's a one or two page of the board get used to seeing on every month and say, hopefully every month, yep, I'm in the green zone, everything's operating as expected, or hey, something looks a little bit amiss here, let's talk about that.
Use me as the lowest common denominator, something I'll understand.
Fair enough.
Approaching E.
Are we approaching item 18 on the...
The only thing we didn't touch on was we didn't have a chance for Dave to talk about his process and trustees to hear the DFA actual investment process. If you think you know the DFA investment process, I suppose we could skip that, but I do want to give you a quick chance to educate the trustees if there's any questions there.
7 or 8 minutes. I could just be very brief and talk about basically three
minutes. Believe there's a tea time out there.
Oh, I've got all day. There's nothing I love more than answering questions about our strategy. But just a few minutes on how we come to our term decision. We talked earlier about it. For us, it's about term and credit. Where do you position yourself along the curve? Where do you position yourself across the credit spectrum? And we're going to do it, as we talked about, in a very, very highly diversified way. So it's not going to be concentrated bets in a small number. It's going to be spread out across hundreds. So a few minutes on term, how do we come to that decision, a few minutes on credit, and then just a couple minutes on implementation at the end. So I'll turn you now, you're in the dimensional book at long last, and in the investment philosophy tab, and onto page 11. So, of course, like Evan talked about, that a lot of the details, of course, will get fine-tuned, but the majority of our short-term credit strategies have a maximum duration allowed of 3 years. It's investment grade, 3 year and under. So does that mean we're always at 3 years? Are we married to that that decision on term? And the answer, of course, is no. The work that was done by Professor Fama, going back to the mid-70s, he was studying yield curves. And we show on page 11 a top panel where we have an upwardly sloped yield curve where yields are going up as term is increasing, as the duration is increasing. And then we combine two different yield curves in the bottom, a flat yield curve, where yields, if you looked at the yields on 3 month bills and 3 year notes, they'd be about the same. And then we also show at the on that same panel an inverted yield curve, downwardly sloped, where literally yields a 3 month bill would have a higher yield than a three year note. And Fama is basically studying, is there information about, as yield curves are changing shape, does that tell me something about where interest rates are going to go? You know, and there's a lot of people that thought at the time that, well, if I'm observing an upwardly sloped curve, this market's reflecting their expectations for rising interest rates. Or if I see a downwardly sloped curve, it's reflecting the market's expectations for declining interest rates. And Fama, in the end, is an empirical researcher. There's an empirical question in there. He could go through the data, study upwardly sloped curves, and see if it turned out any more likely that rates did go up. Or I could study, he studied the whole history of inverted curves, and saw, looked to see if it was more likely that rates went down. And basically found that there was no connection there, that if the curve was upwardly sloped, it was just as likely that rates went down that went up. And if the curve was inverted, downward sloped, just as likely that rates went up. So we found no information in yields or security prices to help us figure out where rates are going to go. So it's a very FAMA-like conclusion. But that being said, it allowed him to make another very profound statement about the expected term premium, premium being the extra return you get by extending out a little bit more. And what he found is in upwardly sloped curves, you have higher average expected premiums as you extend out an upwardly sloped curve. But if the curve is flat or inverted, you don't have that same expectation for a premium. We would argue that if the curve is perfectly flat, your expected return is about the same everywhere. And if the expected return on a three-month bill is the same as the expected return on a three-year note, we'll take the three-month bill, because we know that volatility will increase with term. And if the curve is downwardly sloped or inverted, we would argue the expected returns are decreasing as you extend out. So in flat or inverted curves, we're going to be on the very short end. Our range would be 0 to 3 years. In upwardly sloped curves is when we would push out to near our three-year limit. So that would explain generally our term decisions. A very, very disciplined approach. We don't say, the curve is upwardly sloped, but it kind of got a hunch this time that it's not going to work out that way. We don't do that. We know there's 50 years worth of data to suggest that on average your premiums are higher in upwardly sloped curves. We don't know from within the upwardly sloped curves, when are the better upwardly sloped curves than the other. We're going to extend out in all upwardly sloped curves, and we're going to shorten up in all flat or inverted curves. So that's our term decision. You can think of it as we're only willing to take term risk when we expect a positive premium for doing it. If we don't expect a positive premium, we're going to shorten all the way up. From credit, FAMA studied the time-bearing nature of the credit premium. Sometimes the credit premium is large, and sometimes the credit premium is small, and basically found that there is information in credit spreads. Credit spreads are something we can all observe, and on average, when credit spreads are wide, you anticipate a larger credit premium. And when credit spreads are narrow, you anticipate a smaller credit premium. So that's a very, very straightforward conclusion. But basically, it probably matches the intuition of many in the room, maybe even Fama's as well. But Fama, being the sort of the professional researcher, never relies on intuition. He needs to sort of pound out the numbers and prove it to himself that there's a relationship between credit spreads and ultimate credit premiums. So what we'll do is, if you look at on page 12, we show two different credit spread environments. In periods, we look at the one on the right first. In periods when credit spreads are relatively wide, we will tilt the portfolio more in the direction of those single A's and the triple B's. Now, everything has a limit, and we take a very conservative approach on this. Our upper limit on triple B's is the market weight. So we will never have it more risky in triple B's than the market itself. We'll go up to market weights in triple B. Our market weight in the combination of single A's and triple B's is also market weight. So we will go up to market weights when credit spreads are wide, when we anticipate a meaningful credit premium. But when credit premiums are very narrow, spreads are very, very narrow, we will significantly underweight market weights, because not that we're making a forecast that we think spreads are going to widen out and we wish we had shortened. It's just that you're getting paid less to take the same amount of credit risk. Should you be willing to take the same amount? And our answer is no. The amount of credit risk we're willing to take is a function of how much you expect to get paid for it. If you expect to get paid more, you're willing to take more. If you expect it to get paid less, you take less. So we vary the tilts. So on credit, obviously, I had mentioned earlier, simply because something is investment grade rated doesn't mean we always buy every single one. We monitor intensely the credits. Every corporate bond we have, there's a probability of default. You can't make that go away. That's the reason you're earning a premium, because that's there. But I can't make it go away, but we know how to manage it. And there'd be two most powerful things you could do. One is to diversify, get spread out over, if you can get up to 300 unique issuers, every individual issuer, average weight in the portfolio will be 0.2% or 0.3%, a very, very small portion. And the second way is to monitor those credits. So how do we monitor those credits? We're looking at this trace data that I talked about. You know, it's show me prices. And I'm not talking about prices that a pricing vendor puts on the security to say, okay, here's what we think it's worth. We want to see transaction prices, where trades are actually taking place. Those are prices I'll believe. This is a trade actually occurred at this level. We get there's about 40,000 of those trades happening every day. We capture all 40,000 data points every single day. We don't wait till the end of the day. We go in 20-minute increments and grab them. And essentially what we're doing is looking for outliers. We're looking for those bonds where the way the bond is trading belies its rating. So you're looking for a security that, let's say, it's rated AA. When I see how those bonds are trading, it's trading at a much wider yield, a much higher yield than all the other AAs. It's trading, let's say, like the AAA or triple Bs. We can map this out, and we do this continuously throughout the day. When you see that sort of mismatch, rated AA, but trading like a triple B, you sort of get to a fork in the road. You say, well, one of two things is going on here. One is that, it's a mispriced bond. It's a bargain. It's cheap, which would suggest, I should hold as much of that as I can because I found this mispriced security. That's not the road we take. That road basically says that the rating agency has properly characterized the risk of the security, but the market's got the price wrong. Our view is the exact opposite. Our view is that the market's probably got the price right, and it's trading like a triple B because it actually is a triple B, and the rating agencies have not yet caught up to the market. So when there's a news event, negative news event, everyone at this table can tell you, the market doesn't wait around for the rating agency. The market starts selling that bond right away, and that starts to get reflected in price. So the ones that we won't buy in an investment grade actually are the highest yielding ones. It's the ones with the widest credit spreads that when we map them out, they're not looking even like investment grade. They're mapping out like speculative grade. Those are specifically the ones that we're not going to buy. So every single security in every portfolio gets assigned an internal rating based on how the market is trading it. Those are monitored, again, 40,000 data points a day, every day in real time. So that's how we're managing those credits across the portfolios. Any questions on term or credit? Okay, and then my last section, I'll just touch briefly on implementation. With every security in every portfolio, a price results in an expected return. We're not forecasting changes in the yield curve. We're not forecasting changes in credit spread. The price determines an expected return. Every time the price changes, the expected return changes. Every security in our portfolio and universe, every time prices change, we're refreshing expected return calculations. We could simply rank order those expected returns, highest to lowest, and we're looking for opportunities. Can we increase the expected return of the portfolio, but stay within all of our guidelines? And I'll touch briefly on the guidelines next. But that's essentially, we know the expected returns. In upwardly sloped curves, for example, the shorter bonds have lower expected returns, the longer bonds have higher expected returns. Can we do an extension trade to increase the expected return? But we have to stay within guidelines. If we are very near our duration limit, that extension trade pushes over. Well, you can't do that trade because you would violate a guideline. So we're looking for ways to increase the expected return. But we want to do it in a very patient and flexible way. I tell people when orders go to a trader, not all orders get executed. Only about half of them get executed. I tell people the most powerful position you could put your trader in is to give him or her the ability to walk away from any trade. So they go out and try to get bids on a bond we want to sell. Sometimes the best bid isn't where they think it ought to be. We say, fine, cancel that one. I'll get you a substitute. You know, we have hundreds of different names. There's no one name that we're in love with, and there's no one name that we're forced to get out. Obviously, if something would get downgraded into speculative grade, it becomes a sell candidate. But the day it gets downgraded is probably the single worst day to actually go sell it. That's when there's this immediate price pressure, what researchers refer to as the clientele effect. Everyone needs out of that bond that day. We'll be patient on those. We will sell them, but we're going to be patient along those lines. So some trades get done, some trades get done. What gets done, we feed back into the portfolio, and every day the process starts over. And then I'll just summarize on the final page in that second, page 18, just some of the risk controls that we have in place. You know, these are ones that my fellows at the table that would no doubt have the same ones in place, but very, very focused on liquidity, as we talked about. Every single security is screened for liquidity. We report to our investment committee every single month on the liquidity status of every single security in all our portfolios. We require highly diversified portfolios. We're diversified by issuer, by guarantor, by industry, even country of risk. There are issuers, they're all U.S. dollar denominated, but issuers from all over the world come into our corporate bond market to issue bonds. It's the biggest and most liquid bond market. We will put limits by where they came from, and we'll look all the way to the ultimate parent. So Toyota Motor Credit, U.S.-based, California-based company for now, we look all the way to Japan and say, that's Japan, and we put limits on that as well. And then, of course, all the obvious governance issues. We have independent compliance that independent from us on the trading desk. They write all the guidelines in. They would look at the investment management agreement. They would code in every single guideline. Our group has no edit privileges over those. We can't change the rule if we don't like it. And it's an independent check every single day. Every single trade we do goes through what we call pre-trade compliance. So we run it through that same system, say, if I do this trade, I'm going to be okay. System will say yes. And then independently post-trade compliance every single night by the compliance group. And then the other forms of independent board and independent audit coming from on this SSAE 16, the former SAS 70 compliance audit, we do that every year as well. So. There's a governance structure in place that maintains independence between compliance and portfolio management. And then any changes to any policy, we have a longstanding saying, I've been debt dimensional for 27 years, no policy on the desk. It goes through the committees. It goes through broad changes. We go through investment policy committee and then on to investment committees. I am a member of both committees, so I always say I never get shut out on a vote. I at least get my own vote. But all of those committees would make any decisions on changes in policy or guideline. And then that change would go over to compliance. That would get written into the code and then onto the portfolios. So with that, I will open up to any questions.
Just one quick question. I know it's getting late, and you are a quantitative manager,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
But throughout the explanation you just made, I just don't know exactly which part of your decision-making point you utilize that quantitative analysis.
It's going to be on term, so first on term and then on credit. So we'll look at the yield curve. Every single day we're looking at the yield curve. We're calculating expected returns for every security along the yield curve for different holding periods. So a three-year bond held for 6 months or held for 12 months or 18 or a two-and-a-half-year bond in health. So we generate what we call a matrix of expected returns that's priced into the current curve every single day. As the curve is changing shape, as the curve is flattening, those expected premiums are shrinking for taking that term risk, and our willingness to take that term risk is shrinking along with the expected premium, and we'll be shortening the portfolio. So that's sort of the quantitative approach on term. On credit, every single day we're looking at credit spreads, and credit spreads ebb and flow. When credit spreads are wide, we have thresholds that we have that if they're above the threshold, we'll go to market weights. In triple B and in single A. As those credit spreads are narrowing, expected premiums are shrinking, and our willingness to be out in triple Bs and single A's is shrinking along with, you know, that expected premium. So we're varying along both dimensions, both term and credit, as not as a function of our forecast for what we think is going to happen to the shape of the curve or credit spreads, but by observing the current curve and the current set of credit spreads, and then. Our understanding of the relationship between those metrics and expected premiums, and our willingness to take risk as a function of the expected premium.
Thank you.
Okay. Any additional questions of Cliff, Dave, Jesse, Bryce? Thank you all.
Thank
Very
you.
Well done, informative presentation. I misspoke. It was item 15 that I think we are